Welcome to the Invest with Clarity podcast, where you will learn how success in investing, as in life, is the result of absolute clarity. Mark Pearson of Nepsis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, shares his passion for portfolio management and commitment to transparency and communication to allow investors to fully understand what they own and why, bringing them to clarity in their investments. And now, here are your co-hosts, Matt Halloran and Mark Pearson.
Hello and welcome to another Invest with Clarity podcast with Mark Pearson. And we've got Chuck again today because this is part three, ladies and gentlemen, of a five-part mini-series on why is knowing what you own and why you own it so important. And I'm just going to go ahead and turn this over to Mark so that he can tell you a little bit about the last two podcasts and what we're going to be talking about today.
Beautiful. Matt, always good to be with you. You are looking as young and spry as ever. Chuck, great to have you with us.
And, great to be here.
Matt shaking his head. You know, having Chuck in this podcast with us, we don't get to banter back and forth as much.
That's okay. He's way better than I am on the podcast anyway, because he's dropping some serious knowledge here, dude.
Oh, boy. Wow. There's the butter flowing. I love it. All right. Well, let's do, as Matt alluded to, folks, this is part three of a five-part series. So very quickly, let me just give you the overview. And if you haven't listened to the first or second episode, we would encourage you to do that because there is a strategic process of why we are going through the one through five the way we are. And of course, number one really was a focus on how you go about eradicating emotions in the investment decisions that you make. We really believe that the more you understand about what you own and why you own it, that it can help in either minimizing or eliminating the emotional decisions that you make as it pertains to investing, because investment decisions should be based upon process, should be based upon fundamental analysis. It should be based upon a strategy, a philosophical and strategic process you have in investing. These things help eradicate emotions when it comes to the investment process. Number two, the headline, the main emotion is fear. How do we get rid of fear as it pertains to our investment process? Remember, emotions was in series one. Well, what's the biggest emotion people probably feel? It is this sense of fear. And how does one overcome the fear? Faith, trust, confidence. People often ask me, what's it like managing money? How come you are so confident in the decisions you make? And that is because we have a fundamental philosophy and strategy behind us that we've literally been using for over two decades in our investment process. And so eliminating fear can have a significant impact on your investment process and, of course, the potential of being a successful investor. Now, we get to number three, number trace, truck of Cinco. Three of five. How would an investor best know what they own and why they own it? And I think that's a great question to which I will turn over to our head of research. For those who have not listened to our podcast before, Chuck has been on my research team now for darn near 15 years. We have a small, yet very smart, educated investment committee. My two top of the four investment committee people have been with me 13 and 15 years respectively. And so we know how each other ticks. And I do fundamentally believe that's one of the reasons why we have had the investment success that we've had, along with our process, of course. So Chuck, why don't I introduce you there and let you answer the question, why would an investor best know what they own and why they own it?
Mark, thanks so much for having me once again. And boy, as always, you teed it up exceptionally well. And I love the word that you used, confidence, which certainly you have, we have. We have confidence in our process. And we want to ask the question, how is confidence earned, right? And we talked a little bit about that. It comes from knowledge. And then you said understanding. The word confidence obviously begins with the letter C. And I think what we're going to hone in today on are two words that are deeply embedded in our process that begin with the letter C. And it's the word conviction, which I can't wait to hear you speak to, because that's one of your most passionate topics, right? And then also yes. the word consistency. So one gains confidence in understanding that their portfolio manager has deep conviction and then is consistent in that. So if I could, Mark, what I wanted to do is speak to a study that was done by Athena Invest. The data was gathered from Thomson Financial. And I'd like to, as we go through this, you speak to the conviction metrics that we use. But what was amazing is in this study, they found out that something referred to as alpha, which just think of this, it's very simply manager value add. How does a portfolio manager add value up and above that of an index? The best idea. So let's just take that word conviction. Let's say, okay, it's your best idea. And this is what I want you to speak to is that the top 10 of any manager, right? Active manager,
right.
6.1% is earned up and above that of the index. The next 10 is 2.3. And then the next 20, it detracts. It's negative 4.7. So talk to our audience, if you will, a little just about how you go about conviction, how the process unearths that. And I really think that that's going to be key to this podcast.
Right. Well, this goes back to our investment philosophy and strategy. And as part of our philosophy and strategy, it's to own 20 to 30 companies in the portfolio. And the reason for that is it's 20 to 30 of our best ideas. And when you have 20 to 30 as your best ideas, you can afford to be picky. So you have your bottom 10, your mid 10, and your top 10. On average, our top 10 holdings make up about 40 to 55% of the total Excellent. Portfolio. And those are the companies that we have the highest level of conviction. So our conviction indicator, put together by one of our other astounding investment committee team members, basically has a conviction of 1 to 10. 10 is ultra, ultra bullish, which is the highest percentage we're going to own in the portfolio. And then all the way down to your 1, which is in your bottom 10 of the companies we own in our portfolio. And so we have, depending on economic conditions, depending on market conditions, valuations within the overall markets and the valuations of the companies that we own, depending on multiple factors that we use, indicators that we look at, we've come up with a conviction indicator that gets us to this point where I wish everything was a 10 in our portfolio, but you know, the reality is it isn't. And so when you have your top 10 convicted positions, and this is very, very important, we could be as high as 5, 7, 8% ownership of that position in the portfolio. Now, some financial advisors and some investors would say, isn't that really risky? I mean, and I even hear people say, I've even heard advisors say, geez, isn't owning individual stocks risky? I mean, Matt, have you ever heard that in your advisor world? I hear advisors say, isn't owning individual stocks risky?
I have heard it a lot. And working with you for the past 3 or 4 years, now I just shake my head in disbelief and I say, I don't really think you know what you're talking about. They don't like that, by the way, just so you know.
They don't.
That kind of makes
sense. And they don't know what they're talking about, because then you say to them, you realize in those equity mutual funds, you own stocks, right?
Yeah.
People have this preconceived notion that a mutual fund is quote unquote less risky. Now, compared to one individual stock, yes. But compared to a portfolio that is well asset allocated of 20 to 30 companies, I would beg to differ. And in many ways, I would actually say it's less risky than owning a mutual fund. First of all, in a mutual fund, you don't know what you own and why you own it, number one. Number two, this also goes for ETFs, exchange traded funds. You don't know what you own. You don't know why you own it. You don't know what your largest holding is. If you don't know what your largest holding is in your portfolio, how can you fundamentally understand how much risk you're taking in your portfolio?
Exactly.
Period. End of story. It's not negotiable. It's not something you can argue and debate. If you don't know what you own and why you own it, or at least have the ability to know why you own it, because most investors don't care why they own it. They just quote unquote want to see performance. The reality is that when you don't know, that level of no clarity, I believe, is one of the most riskiest things you can be looking at. So in finishing up your question, our conviction usually will provide us to put us in a position of owning companies at the higher end and at the lower end based on our conviction. Now, we're in a period, as you know, Chuck, we've talked a lot about this in the investment community.
Yep.
Regarding what has happened over the last 18 months. As COVID started, we had the fastest pullback, I think, of over 30, 40%, maybe ever in history.
Ever.
And the rebound was as fast as ever in history.
Absolutely.
And I think that brought a level of understanding to people very quickly, the power of volatility and the power of strategic cost averaging, which we've talked about, and the power of knowing what you own and why you own it. And lastly, the power of conviction as we ended up buying companies at a high percentage level when they were beaten up last year. Take, for example, a company like Discover, where mm-hmm. we took a high conviction position at $25 a share, and today it's $130. So the lesson is volatility, the lesson is flexibility, and the lesson is transparency, knowing what you own, why you own it. And lastly, the lesson is conviction.
So very well said, Mark. And I think this actual concept of conviction is so important that I just wanted to highlight a second study, if I can, that actually portrays this as probably being the characteristic that an active manager should actually entertain and would be one of the criteria that an advisor and or an investor would want to use. So this one was done by RS Investments. They did it for the last decade from 2000, 2010. They're in the process of updating this. But basically, here's what they did. Now, we have a broader definition of conviction. We use many factors. Right. They basically said a more concentrated portfolio, so lower number of holdings and low turnover. We use strategic cost averaging. That's not turnover, right? Turnover is when you buy something and then you immediately fully liquidate it. But what they found is not only international mid and small cap managers outperformed that were high conviction, large cap managers did. And here was the key, Mark, and I'd like you to speak to this. As long as one is not a closet indexer and the holdings that they are actually owning are different than the broader index, managers do have the ability to outperform if they stick to their conviction, as we're going to get into the next piece here, if they're consistent in their conviction.
Well, you're bringing up a lot of great points there. Number one is, as you know, and as many of our listeners know from listening to our podcast over time, we don't index and we don't use benchmarks.
Exactly.
We think that the only benchmark investors should be concerned about is whether or not their investments are helping them accomplish their financial planning goals, whether it's retirement, giving, whatever it may be, making sure that their portfolio is doing what they need it to do to help them accomplish their goals. Because when you use a benchmark, you put yourself in a position of not only trying to compare yourself, which 100% of the time, that comparison is not going to be apples to apples, number one. And number two, it puts you in a mindset of having to force yourself potentially to do things you maybe wouldn't do so you can make up for maybe a lack of quote unquote performance in that index. The fact of the matter is that indexes are, frankly, in my opinion, are over diversified. The percentages of what's owned in each company don't have a dramatic impact on the portfolio's performance. Hence the reason why investors have this position of, well, quote, I invest in the stock market. And the reality is you don't invest in the stock market, you invest in businesses. The stock market is nothing more than the greatest tool created to ever bring buyers and sellers of businesses together. So what we look at is this idea, Chuck, that we want to own great businesses over time. And economic conditions change, technology changes, employment changes, black swan events happen, all these different things happen that go into, among other things, that go into this process of deciding your asset allocation. So I had someone ask me recently in the investment business, they were looking at our what we do and how we do it. And they said, well, if you don't use a benchmark and you don't publish your returns, how am I supposed, if I become a client of yours, how am I supposed to know whether or not you're doing a good job or not? And I said, that's a great question. Well, first of all, with us, you have a financial advisor. Your financial advisor should be telling you if you're doing well or not. That's number one. Number two, what's the turnover? How many clients have left Nepsis in the last 7-8 years from your firm? And so the benchmark of whether or not you do a good job or not isn't whether or not you quote unquote beat a benchmark. It's whether or not you are meeting and exceeding clients' expectations.
Absolutely, Mark. And it's incredible as to how little the actual vetting process of portfolio managers even goes down that pathway. They start using modern portfolio theory statistics, which don't amount to a hill of beans, and they don't listen to the portfolio manager. What I love about you, and I want to kind of pivot to this, if you will, when a portfolio manager speaks so passionately about the conviction of their holdings, it's almost like listening to a first-time mother or father or even a grandfather or mother speak about a newborn, right? On the other hand, when money managers speak meekly about stocks that they had to purchase to go around the periphery of the portfolio, basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's laying mediocre companies for a lack of conviction. And we, that's what we refer to as over diversification. I'm going to give you the Buffett quote, and then I want you to comment on this. So here's what Warren Buffett said, and this is just excellent. So he's speaking about his own strategy. He said, the strategy we've adopted precludes our following standard diversification dogma, which is what? The more, the better, right? But many pundits would say that the strategy must be riskier, right? If you have a lower amount of holdings than employed by conventional investors. He disagrees, as do we. We believe the policy of portfolio concentration may well decrease risk if it raises, it should, both the intensity, right, which is conviction, with which an investor thinks about a business, and the comfort level he must feel with its economic characteristics before buying into it. Basically, Buffett is saying, the lesser, the better. If I understand the business, if I have conviction, I'm using consistency in my process, that's less risky than owning a 1,000 stock portfolio that no money manager can track. Am I correct in that?
Dead on. Not to mention what the components are of the strategy that you go about in terms of the decisions that you make for the businesses that you own
exactly
in the portfolio. And here's the reality. Sectors, whether it's technology, financial, materials, retail, go down the list, utilities, whatever the list is. Sectors go in and out of favor for investors. Some go out of favor short term. Some, like materials in particular, can go out of favor for longer periods of time, but they go in and out of favor. And I think part of what people need to realize is that in the financial media, the job of the media is to engage you to be interested in what they're saying, because they sell advertising dollars.
Exactly.
And they want you to keep your eyeballs on the screen. So they talk about things that they think you will be interested in. For an example, cryptocurrency these days. For a while, it was the FANG stocks. These buzzwords they come up with to keep you engaged. But the reality is, it's less important to know about a particular sector and more important to know about the businesses that you own in your portfolio and the conviction surrounding those businesses. And remember, I always tell investors, I'm going to be wrong 100% of the time. Let me say that one more time. I'm going to be wrong 100% of the time when it comes to making a decision to invest in a company. In other words, after I buy into that company, it goes down after I buy it. So you can't time buying a business. It's not timing a business, it's time in a business. And the longer, as Jeremy Siegel says, the longer you own stocks, and in my opinion, a stock or a sector, the less risky it becomes.
Absolutely. Jeremy Siegel is one of our favorites, and he is actually, I think, probably the most highly quoted professor, probably one that absolutely knows what he's doing, like many others, right?
Yeah, I love Jeremy Siegel. I've been following him for years. Warren Buffett, Jeremy Siegel.
Absolutely.
Peter Lynch. Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, I wanted to bring you to, we got probably about 10 minutes left here, Mark, and I want to get your opinion on these four things here, because these are what I would call as strangleholds that the investment industry has on portfolio managers, because we pretend that kind of this rampant and pervasive over-diversification is not the result of a man or a woman going about their job trying to find the best businesses. It's the constraints that lay on top of them. So I'm going to give four, and then I'd like you to speak to these. Okay, so the first one is this, and maybe I'll go through them and you can speak to them individually after that. So many large fund companies, right? The job is to grow the fund. That's how they make money. And when they grow the fund, the capacity of what was once a 40 stock portfolio, now because so much money's rushed in because it's a 5-star fund, now it gets up to 70, 80, 100. What that does is it forces the money manager to buy companies that he or she doesn't like. The second one is this, and we've gone through this personally, right? The Morningstar style box grid stranglehold says, if you stray from your box, Mr. or Ms. Fund Manager, you actually are doing a disservice to your actual clients, when in fact, that's not the case, as you just spoke. The third one is, many fund companies believe in this low standard deviation, low beta, and they want to mute volatility. It makes the fund more attractive. And the last one, I'll end with this, Mark, and this is what you say this better than anyone. They want to avoid criticism, right? You said benchmarks are only excuse to justify someone's job. If the fund itself is straying from its actual original style box, if it's growing too big and they're picking too many stocks, they're trying to keep volatility down, and the manager doesn't want to have criticism, they do what they're told. And that's when you talk about flexibility, which our process has, that's what I want you to just define as the elixir to these four things that our industry holds over portfolio managers.
Right. So great points. So first of all, we throw a lot of big buzzwords around, like modern portfolio theory, style box, all these things. These have been covered in previous podcasts. But this is one of the reasons why people have asked me to start a hedge fund. People have asked me to start a mutual fund. I don't like them. And the reason why I don't like them is they don't follow all four of our four keys to successful investing, which are philosophy, strategy, flexibility, and transparency. And while you can have flexibility in a hedge fund or a mutual fund, it's hard to have transparency. Let me explain what I mean by that. In a mutual fund, they report their holdings on a quarterly basis. But during the quarter, there's lots of activity going on within the portfolio that you don't necessarily know about and can't see. And while there are many disadvantages, in my opinion, of owning mutual funds, that lack of transparency is huge. That's a problem for an individual investor, because every investor has different investment objectives. They have different goals. They have different things they want to accomplish with the money that they're investing. This is why we prefer the separately managed account process. Everyone's money is their own money. It's not commingled with anyone else. You may all own the same companies, and the portfolios may look very similar at the end of the day, but it's your own portfolio. And that's better for you as an investor, because it gives you greater flexibility, because let's face it, in life, things come up, things change. People need money monthly when they're in retirement. In an SMA, you have tons more flexibility on what to sell to get cash. You can tax manage your account so much more. You just have so many more benefits. And lastly, as we grow as a firm, people have said, well, what happens when you get to a billion or 2 billion? I said, our ability to scale is super easy because no one's accounts are commingled. Everyone's going to own the same companies at the appropriate time. And everyone's going to own that 20, 30, 35 companies. And it's not going to force me to say, gee, I got to go buy more stocks and over diversify the client's portfolio. Right. So that's management. I mean, that's massive. Number two, we talked about smaller is better. That issue in a mutual fund is true. In our case, it's not necessarily true because, as I just mentioned, that scalability, because everybody owns the same companies, but they're not all commingled together. And if people could get the clarity, understand the power behind that, they would find how much greater flexibility they have, how much more power they have in their portfolio. This is frankly why we don't lose assets. We don't lose clients because people, as soon as we make a new position, we did yesterday, we made a new position. The client can log in their account and see what new company we just bought. They don't have to wait until the end of the quarter to see what was purchased, what business was purchased with their money. Let's be blunt. Let's call it what it is. It's your money, not my money. It's your money.
Exactly.
You hired us to be the stewards of your money. And since it's your money, I realize that you're super busy. You got a lot of other things to do. And you're going to say, look, I'm hiring the professionals to take care of my money. And that's fine. And that's legitimate. But there's always a time where you want to say to yourself, most people say, gee, I wonder what I have in my portfolio. Gee, the market's making me nervous. I better go look at my accounts. And then they look and they see the businesses that they own. Now, Chuck referred to this idea of tracking a style box, tracking the investments that they are so-called supposed to buy. Many firms put guidelines, put guardrails up on what they can buy, what they can't buy. Wrong. You want the most amount of flexibility possible to invest in great businesses without having others tell you what you can and cannot buy. Because if it's a great business, then why wouldn't you want to be owning that great business? And if you want to overweight a certain sector, because at any given time, the markets or the one sector may be way overvalued to another, you want ultimate flexibility to take advantage of the opportunities to strategic cost average into those businesses that you want to own based on your investment philosophy and strategy. Ultimate flexibility leads to ultimate clarity. Last, we're taught volatility is risk. You talked about standard deviation. You talked about beta. I'm not going to get into all the technicalities of what these terms mean, but basically they are statistical measurements used to determine, quote unquote, how a fund measures performance relative to risk. But much of the risk is based on volatility. But volatility is not risk. Volatility is opportunity. So now you're going to pigeonhole me to try to reduce the volatility in my portfolio so that I have less volatility, so I feel better at night. But the reason why you want to feel better and have less volatility is flat out because you don't know what you own and you don't know why you own it. If you knew what you owned, you knew why you own it, or had the ability to know what you own or why you own it. Look, you can own Citigroup and you may not care why you own it, but the fact that you know that you own Citigroup and you go, gee, that's a really good company, I'm not going to worry about that. These are things that allow you to embrace volatility. And many of our clients, quite frankly, during volatile periods, they call their advisors and say, I'm putting more money to work. I want to put more money to work because I think now is a great time to buy more of these businesses we own. That's the attitude you want to have. So this idea of beta and standard deviation, I hate them. I like higher volatile stocks. And people go, why would you like higher volatile stocks? Well, gee, I don't know. Does anyone remember the COVID crash and the higher volatile stocks went down 50, 60, 70%? Thank you for allowing me to buy Square at 23 after it dropped from, I don't know, 76. Now, a year and a half later, trading at 280.
Yeah.
That is the key right there.
Mark, you nailed it. And I was thinking about this here as we just set up the next podcast, which will be number four here. And we talked about, again, clarity, right? The knowing what you own and why you own it, but the kind of the three C's, confidence, right? Conviction and consistency. And what we're going to do, and this is, I'm going to love doing this in our next podcast, is we're going to put kind of the Nepsis portfolio to the test. And the test, we're going to look at these four things that you just went over, right? The number of stocks held. You just said it, the fewer, the better, ideally less than 40. We're going to talk about how many we currently own, right?
Yep.
You mentioned about owning and having an SMA platform versus a broad-based collective.
SMA,
the smaller, the better when you have assets. And then the two which are key, the tracking error. Actually, the greater, the better. I want, you want, we all want portfolio managers that have that flexibility to move outside of the style box, which see where our portfolio is. And lastly, volatility, here it comes. The greater, the better. Now, this is going to be a set of words here that maybe for many people they may not know, but cross-sectional dispersion, it's just what Mark just said. In times of greatest volatility, the actual performers that have the greatest impact on returns are those that have that wider dispersion.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to do, Mark, in the next podcast, is we're going to look at our own portfolio, give a little bit insight into the philosophy and strategy, and put it to the test and see actually if we meet those four qualities that have the best impact on clients' portfolios.
Well, as you know, the famous quote from Shelby Davis, most people make the most money. People make the most money during bear markets. Amen. They just don't realize it at the time.
Exactly.
That's a great quote. They just don't realize it at the time. During the greatest pain, that's where you make the greatest amount of money. But people think that by looking at their statement, they've made or lost money. No, you don't make or lose money until you sell a position. I love it. I'm looking forward to the next podcast. Chuck,
Mark.
Great job. I'll tell you what, Biggie, you set this thing up perfect. Uncle Matt, any remarks from you? Any thoughts?
I just think this is wonderfully organized and refreshing. For those of you who have listened or do listen to other financial podcasts, you're going to notice through this mini series, just once again, how differently Nepsis, Mark, and Chuck think about things. And it does force you to challenge your existing paradigms of misunderstanding and misinformation that's out in the marketplace. And by understanding things and looking at things with just a little bit different of a perspective, by the way, that's based on all sorts of great research, but you know, making sure that you're really taking a look at things a little bit differently can make a huge impact on not only what you're going to do now, but also what you're going to do in the future.
Beautiful. Beautiful. You're always too kind to us.
You've converted me. I don't know if anybody else feels that way, but it just makes me giggle when I hear other people say stuff that is a widely held belief. And I just like, yeah, no, I could argue that point pretty successfully. So with that, everybody, if you have not subscribed to the podcast, make sure you click that subscribe now button below. That way, every time we come out with a new show, it'll show up on your listening device. And if you don't mind, share this with somebody who you absolutely love and needs to know this information. And finally, give us a quick review on any player that you have. And so for Mark and Chuck, this is Matt Halloran, and we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
The content discussed is for informational purposes only. It is not a solicitation or recommendation for any securities that may be mentioned herein. Advisory services offered through Nepsis, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor.